Hello and welcome to QSO. It's all about ham radio. This week, our co-host is with us, Frank Howell, K4FMH, along with our special guest, Bill Perkins, his call sign KB4KFT. So don't touch that dial. QSO is on the air. And I want to welcome our guests in tonight. First off, I want to say hello to Frank Howell. K4FMH, he is our co-host tonight. Hello, Frank.
Hello, Ted. A question for you, sir.
Uh-huh.
How many fractured ribs do you have?
I don't have any, but I was kind of going to rib you about it.
Yeah, that's a good one. You're going to rib me about it. Well, I now officially have five fractured ribs. I played chicken with a tile floor and lost.
Oh, I was going to say, you're just going to have to stop going out late at night trying to knock off those convenience markets.
Well, I mean, there's some people in South Jackson have a cartel on that, so I can't compete.
I was going to say, you know, maybe we can work out a deal with some of these ham radio manufacturers and you won't have to resort to that, you know. I appreciate you being on board with cracked ribs. You were here last week, though. You had cracked ribs, and
Was just not official yet. You know, it's kind of like I did the QSO, but hadn't got the QSO card for it. I got the QSO card for it this week.
Well, we also want to say hello to Bill Perkins, and I believe the call sign is KB4KFT. Am I correct?
That is correct.
And hello, Bill. Welcome aboard. And
good evening, guys.
We're all on QSO Live. Yeah,
and
that brought some silence. It brought out silence, and everybody talks at the same time.
This is one of the well-known, although there are many, they're one of the well-known hams in the greater Atlanta, Georgia area. And it's been a pleasure watching Bill exercise some leadership in the Atlanta Radio Club, both as the official leader in residence, i.e. president, but also in other roles and capacities. But Bill has got a new idea, and he's going to talk with us about that this evening.
Now, you were telling me about this, and I was really impressed. And why I'm impressed is because this is something that anybody can participate in. In other words, anybody can do this in their own hometown. And a lot of times, amateur radio projects aren't like that. You're dependent on so many other things, one of which could be money, location and whatnot, and travel and all kinds of things. But this, when you told me about this, this is like super cool. So it sounds to me like, Bill, you're a genius. This is something that everybody needs to know about.
We're talking about the L Expedition concept, correct?
That is correct.
Okay. Yeah, I wouldn't say genius so much as desperate. The origins of it, I'll give you real quick, and then y'all can take over again. I used to visit my mom. She passed away a couple of years ago, but I would go sit with her two or three, four times a year. Mom chain smoked. So at the end of 9 hours of a visit, I needed fresh air in the worst kind of way. And if I'm going to be sitting out in the middle of the mountains, she was in the eastern part of Tennessee, I might as well do something. And so the idea came to put up a cheap antenna, set up a radio in the back of the car, a picnic table, and operate for a couple hours. It's just that simple.
Well, you know, I guess, you know, what this kind of reminds me of is David is with us here. Say hello, David.
And good evening there.
And hey. You give your call signs.
So this is KG4WXW.
What's KB4KFT?
What he would do is he would go to the local park and take my grandson with him, and he would set up a portable antenna and sit down at a picnic table with the radio on it and the antenna set up and sit there and work in the park. And people would come by and watch and look and like, what are you doing? Now, I know this is a different concept than what you're talking about, but I guess I see a similarity there in that it is a totally local, innovative idea, something to do that makes amateur radio fun, but yet keeps it at home, you know, and affordable.
But we actually do, through the Atlanta Radio Club and through another related group that's called the Second Sunday Technical Session, and right now it's being run by Newt, N4EWT, and Jim, N4BFR. We do two or three times a year an outing in the park specifically to be seen. We pick a park that's public, usually have a lot of people, and I know personally I have gotten three or four people on the air who had never even heard of ham radio before, and when they left there, they were interested. One young lady who got in, I won't mention any names, but one young lady who got into it, her brother came to see what we were doing because we'd advertised it, and he was over there playing with the radio, and she looked bored, so I got her on my old ICOM 751A. She's an extra now.
That's incredible.
Wow.
You know, hands-on is always, I mean, hands-on is always the best thing. I mean, I don't know. I remember my first radio job at a huge station. I mean, I'd worked at a lot of radio stations, but this thing was a monster. And I was so intimidated by it until I sat down behind the microphone. Yeah. And I was intimidated for about 30 minutes, and then after that I had become addicted. And I think amateur radio is that way. If you can get people involved in it and get them past the first 15 minutes of their nervousness, I guess I want to say, and they start enjoying it, they will be a ham for life.
And some of the kids just get it. You know, there's a magic to it. I see that we all have call signs. There's a magic to the point where you first realize there's a live person on the other end of that, whether it's broadcast radio or not. For me, it was John Sigma at WOWO way back in the 60s. It just dawned on me one night, he's a live man sitting somewhere talking to me right now. That's where I got the magic, and spent a lot of years doing shortwave listening and whatnot before I got into ham. But you could see the at this park, the 10-year-old boy just got kind of bored in it, but the young lady, she absolutely got it, and I could just see, you know, there was an excitement to her, like, wow, this could be cool, and she pursued it. So maybe 1 in 100 gets it, but that 1 in 100's enough.
But Ted, you know, the big idea, the big D expedition, you know, NAVASA and so on, it's gotten so expensive now. And as the world has gotten more complicated politically, all the permissions and, you know, and things of that nature, it reminds me of that that Southernism that we use. You know, when we're almost ready to do something, we say we're fixing to do something. Well, with de-expeditions, there's a lot of fixing to do it before you do it. And I think to some degree that's put up a paywall, if you will, both in terms of your own personal investment and then the overall investment of how many hams can truly do a de-expedition. Well, what Bill's done, as he said, out of desperation, but I've watched him hone this craft from everything from, hey, on Tuesday at noon, with the area hams in Atlanta who are probably working, go out to your parking deck and let's get on 10 meter sideband and let's just see who can hear one another. And let's just see what we can do. Let's see where 10 meters is coming into this next sunspot cycle. Or Bill's headed down to Tybee Island just for a getaway weekend. Well, I'm going to pack my portable rig and I'll try to work you guys on 40 meters. I'll be around or about on some frequency. And that takes a lot of that paywall out of it, because it keeps it pure in terms of the action. And I must say that while calling DX from NAVASA is terribly exciting and trying to work really exotic places, it's still pretty darn exciting just trying to work Tybee Island from Atlanta on 40 meters at relatively low power.
You know, I'll tell you something, though. There's another side to this, and I've never expressed this, but I'm going to express it now. Why do I think that what Bill has come up with is an ingenious idea? Is because, you know what? There's some of us that even though we love ham radio and we like participating in ham radio and we love rag chewing and we love all these different things, there's no desire to get on an airplane or a boat and fly to some godforsaken place where nobody even lives or can live, you know, and unload generators and all kinds of stuff and put up tents and sleep in the most horrible conditions, swatting mosquitoes, fighting snakes and scorpions in order to make a contact overseas. I mean, now there's some of us that look at that and say, you know what? Forget that, you know. Okay? Now, but there's so many other aspects of the hobby. Now, I love listening to it. I love listening to these de-expeditions. I like working the guys that are there. But I want them to have all the scorpions they want. You know, I mean, I don't want to come and hog the scorpions from them. So that's my take on it. I'm sorry. Bill, you go ahead. You're next here.
I was tempted when you were talking about the mosquitoes and the horrible conditions to mention an operation I went on in a state that's north of Virginia. But if I do that, I think I'll get in trouble, so I'll just keep my mouth shut. Some of these things have gone really bad, especially when I'm out by myself. A couple years ago, and this is kind of a warning, before I go any further, we do have a group on Yahoo called L Expeditions Atlanta. The sole purpose of that is just to, you know, post what worked and what didn't, what antennas worked and what didn't, what went wrong and what didn't. But anyway, I was out a couple years ago, and it was around Christmas time, and I had done it from near Watauga Lake up in East Tennessee. And it was kind of nasty and rainy, so I got in the back of the car. And as a change, I actually got in the car and closed the door and worked from inside. Normally, I work from the back deck. When I went to open the door, an hour later, it was frozen shut. And I found out that we had had ice rain, freezing rain, for the last hour. And because I was in the car paying attention to the radio and talking to the guys, I lost track of what was going on outside. So there are some risks to the way I do it. But the park idea, you know, we do three or four a year here. KC4ZUA, his name is Arnold. Arnold and I used to do the Strange Antenna Challenge in March, in May. And it's almost exactly the same principle, except we included a cookout. We had barbecue and food and everything. And the trick with the Strange Antenna Challenge, it's a national event, is to try to make an antenna out of something that's not supposed to be an antenna, like a barbecue grill. I made a real good 10-meter antenna out of a bicycle. And people see this kind of thing, you know, it can show them that there is some fun to be had in the hobby. It's not all... honestly, when I talk to somebody and ask them why they got in the hobby and they say, you know, emergency communications, as good as that is, I know that they're going to miss at least half the fun.
Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to QSO. We'll be right back with our co-host Frank Howell, K4FMH, and our special guest Bill Perkins, KB4KFT, right after this. You've heard us talk about the CC Skywave radio. And the only way you can do this radio justice is you have to hold one in your hand. You have to own it. You have to be able to take it out in the backyard or take it, slip it in your pocket as you travel around. It's a beautiful travel radio. Probably the best travel radio that you could possibly ever want to own. Okay, it's got AM on it, a very hot AM radio section. FM, FM stereo. It's got Weather Alert Plus. It's also got the shortwave bands, 2.3 to 26.1 megahertz continuous tuning. And it also has the air aviation band. You have direct entry of frequencies and plus auto scan and store. Can you believe that? A lighted LCD display, selectable fast or fine tuning on all bands except weather. There are 400 memory presets on this radio, and it runs on two AA alkaline batteries, all right, and it runs forever. There's a stereo headphone jack and a fold-out backstand. Of course, you've seen those. The clock with 12 or 24-hour format. The alarm that's on it as well. And there's a rotary volume knob, which is kind of cool. I hate the knobs you have to push on them, you know, and turn the volume up and down. It comes with high-quality CC buds, the earphones, and a carrying case along with a one-year warranty. Now, you can order the SkyWave radio right now. To order, all you have to do is call 1-800-522-8863. That's 1-800-522-8863. Or visit them at ccrane.com. You have to mention WTWW. And the reason why we want you to do that is Bob Crane wants to know that you're supporting him as he brings you Midnight in the Desert, the Art Bell Show, as well as some of the music programming we have here on WTWW. Once again, the phone number 1-800-522-8863. That's 522-8863. Or go to ccrane.com and be sure and mention WTWW. Here at the QSL Radio Show, we really need to hear from you. Go to our website, simply QSOradioshow.com. That's QSOradioshow.com. And you'll see all the past podcasts up there and other information. But go to the part where it says email Ted and send us an email. And be sure and put on that email, I want to win, because always giving something away. Go to the website. It's simply QSOradioshow.com and send us an email. And while you're at it, be sure and friend us on Facebook, QSO Radio Show, and follow us on Twitter, QSO Radio Show. And thank you for listening. Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to QSO. And now back to our co-host, Frank Howell, K4FMH, and our special guest, Bill Perkins, KB4KFT. And I believe that's true. Go ahead, Frank.
Let me amplify something Bill said. When I was in Atlanta for about 3 years, there was a young guy, and I forget his name and call sign now, but he is in Rochester, New York, or has probably graduated. This strange antenna challenge drew this junior college student from Peachtree City, Georgia, into tinkering with two hollow tubes of salt water as an antenna. And Bill, you know who I'm talking about.
No, you've got your people mixed up.
That's typical.
That was KI4UTY. That was Rob who came in. He was trying to build a 20-meter saltwater antenna, and he realized that the cement wouldn't dry fast enough, and so it ended up being a 2-meter saltwater antenna.
I see. Okay. There was a young man from Peachtree City, and this is a limerick in the making, I can tell, who was also interested in that. And what was cool about it was that he went up to Rochester, New York, to do some work in that area. Lo and behold, guess what the U.S. Navy has been pioneering for the last 7 or 8 years? Saline antennas.
Yep.
Why? Submarines don't have to go necessarily to the surface, you know, to do the communication. So part of what Bill is saying, there's probably just, to use another good old Southernism, oodles. I'm not sure what the mathematical definition of that is, just oodles of people who have gotten the magic, whether it's from an aluminum extension ladder from Lowe's that you make tunable by changing the length or what have you. Now, Ted, I'm going to throw one on you you're a bona fide radio engineer, but I want to ask you, have you ever heard of anyone who can do AM on an FM repeater?
AM on an FM repeater. Well, you know,
yes.
I guess the repeater itself would have an FM transmitter. But I can honestly say I have heard I've heard some things like that. I mean, I've heard people transmitting some pretty strange things over a repeeter.
Do you know the answer to this question?
I've not seen it done, but I would not imagine that. I would imagine it can be done.
Bill and I have heard it done. Now, Bill, are you following my wavelength?
You
mentioned this person who can do this just a moment ago.
I'm sitting here trying to figure out which disadvantage is coming up.
KC4ZUA.
Oh, Arnold.
If you ever hear Arnold, you'll hear Arnold modulation, Ted, on an FM repeater.
Oh, okay, I got you. Yeah, he has a very distinctive voice pattern. Do him some justice now. Don't be mean to him. He has a very distinctive voice pattern, and you can tell it's Arnold, even if he's in the noise. We call it Arnold modulated static.
He is one of the ham characters in the greater Atlanta area, and I mean that with true affection.
Yeah, and he's a mover and shaker on the Strange Antenna Challenge, and he was one of the early movers and shakers with L Expedition. And he and I used to go out and build antennas outside the Strange Antenna Challenge concept. We would build antennas out of wire that you could barely see and put 100 watts into it, and it worked fine. So he really got me interested in designing and building antennas.
Now, he has several patents for a large power company, and he's pioneered the wireless meter reading business. So he is a man of considerable talents.
Yep.
But I have to tease him, being a transplant from New York, he sort of has a conjugated Southern accent that is truly distinctive.
No. The Southern part of his accent is he talks slow. The rest of it's pure Yankee. Pure New York.
And for our international listeners, this is a geography lesson in the United States of America.
Okay, and then for all of our folks that are up in Michigan and Ohio and the northern part of the country, I'm here in the Tennessee area near Nashville, and people south of here, we're very careful not to talk too loud because they really honestly don't know that the Civil War is over. Okay, they don't know. They have no clue. They have no idea who won. You know, it's just we just have to kind of go along with it.
There are quite a number of hams in Atlanta who are truly characters, as I'm sure there are in Nashville and Detroit and Boston and L.A. and everywhere. But Arnold is certainly one of those as well. Bill, I want to ask you a couple of questions about this. You've been doing this for a number of years. And have you had other chapters, sort of informally speaking? Has this gone to other places? Have other groups around the country learned of the L Expedition, and have they begun doing some of this?
Yes, it has to some degree. One of the rules that we put in place early on with L Expeditions Atlanta was you have to participate to be a member. And I was turning down maybe 5 or 6 requests a week of people who just saw the name and thought it was interesting. You know, and the thing, if you hear us on the radio, you know, if you see us publish an event, you can read the message. You can't answer them. I've had several people come back off the group and ask me, you know, how hard it is to run. Well, it's not hard. You just set up a group and go. There's one somewhere around Oklahoma City, or there was a couple of years ago, and there were a couple of guys in Michigan around the lake who wanted to do something like this with their boats. Those are the two that I know of as a fact. And the Michigan guys asked if they could use the name L Expeditions. Well, sure, why not? I mean, we were talking about doing an outing, and it just popped into somebody's head on the repeater one Thursday morning. We don't own that name. It's not copyrighted. But yeah, there are several groups that have picked it up. And when we publish an event on the group, it's always going to be the date, the time, and the frequency with instructions on what to do if that frequency is in use at the time. We don't want to interfere with anybody. I routinely have people check in, at least at the beginning, from all over the country. They're sitting there listening to it, and my phone will start getting text messages, or I'll start getting emails. You know, I can hear you, but you can't hear me, or whatever. So there's hundreds and hundreds of people watching this group who are not members.
Okay, now I'm gonna put the brakes on right here because you guys are talking. Here's what's happening, folks. Now, Frank knows exactly what it is that Bill and his group are doing. They're talking about LX, you know, and they both know what they're talking about. But I'm sitting here, and I'm just like the rest of the audience. I haven't got the slightest idea. So I think what you need to do is start from the beginning and explain the mechanics behind this, because I understand what little bit Frank explained to me. It sounds like it's really cool, but I don't understand the mechanics. So how does this work? Teach us.
Okay, I'm sorry. I thought we had hit that earlier on.
well, it didn't again, stick with me.
Okay, we go back to the very beginning then. My mom used to chain smoke, et cetera, et cetera. And other people jumped on. I would post, you know, Saturday night, 9 o'clock, 7254, which is my favorite frequency, down by 3 if it's busy until we find a hole. And if that doesn't work, we go to 80. Sometimes it gets pretty complicated. It depends on how complicated the person's doing it is. And then Arnold did a couple from out west. And then other people started joining in. We created the group, and it started growing, and we called it L Expeditions Atlanta. As opposed to a D expedition. The concept behind an L expedition is if everything that could go wrong goes wrong, you can walk home. And then, of course, like Frank said, we extended that a little bit into group activity around 10 meters at lunchtime. We extended it again a little bit with some PSK 31 in the evenings on 80. Whoever is in the group comes up with an idea. If he can state the idea clearly enough, you know, we'll take a shot at it. But from my point of view, the L expedition basically is one person sitting somewhere with a radio in a park, in the back of the car, doesn't matter where it is, a very temporary setup, advertise the frequency of the date and the time ahead of time, and we go find him.
Now, is this, when you say we go find him, is this like a...
Well, on the frequency. And like in my case, I may be at Tybee Island. I'm not going to expect anybody to come driving up to me. But, you know, I say we'll start at 7254 and go down by 3 until we find a hole. I may end up way down somewhere. And, you know, the guys need to come down to band and find where I am. But, you know, some of us stick directly to the plan. If we say down by 3, we'll be down by 3 somewhere. And then the whole idea is just to get people interested in doing something with ham radio. And the more people we can get out actually doing something, the better.
So, in other words, what you're doing is you're announcing that you're going to be on a certain frequency and you're going to be operating, you know, upside down from the apple tree in somebody's backyard that you don't know. And then what it is all of the amateurs that find out about this are going to try to find you and make contact with you.
Yeah, that's basically it. And we turn it more or less like a 2-meter drive time thing. We just go round robin and everybody takes turns. For me, of course, is I get to talk to my friends, and my friends are actually doing something radio related, and some of them will go set up portable themselves on when we do this, and some of them go out and do it. KF4UPO goes to Florida or goes to Texas or Oklahoma. He tries it from there. The way I know that something was working is I come up on frequency maybe 10 minutes early to check the antenna. And if I'm working 80 meters, I have to do some tweaking with the antenna because it's 3 feet off the ground. It does tend to couple with the dirt pretty good. So it usually takes me a few minutes to get that real low antenna working effectively. And the number of people that are actually on the frequency who have read the listing, you know, have read the posting and know where to look for me, but then they don't participate in the event. They drop off either as we come up on the time to start, or they come in and talk to me after we're done. They'll sit there and listen to the entire 2 or 2.5 hours, and then as soon as I say, you know, I'm monitoring, I'll get 3 or 4 calls from people who, you know, were looking for us, just didn't choose to talk.
You know, and Ted, here's what it likens to me, is a little bit about the concept of handicapping in golf. You know, the concept of handicapping in the sport of golf means that you sort of equalize each player. So for a given round, you should theoretically, you know, not have a real advantage of being a better player as a rule. Well, one of the things I've observed about the Atlanta group is that they may, you know, do something on a given band when maybe the conditions are not optimal, but just sort of to see, or the fish biting here in terms of the propagation. Or they may do something else. A related net that has been, I don't know if it's still on or not, Bill, was a QRP net in North Georgia. And basically, I used to get onto that net from Mississippi with a G5RV up about 125 feet in the air between two pine trees. And I actually was net control for that net a couple of times when there was a small amount of traffic. But you had one guy in North Carolina who said he was only putting out a half a watt on sideband voice.
Yeah.
And we had a QSO. So it's sort of kind of, if you think of the unconference, concept where you don't go to a nice hotel and everybody pack in and hear each other talk, but you do it on a website and people come and go. There's a little of that element that you don't have to have quite as much preparation as you would for a formal de-expedition, which means you're more likely to do it, and you're more likely to do it more frequently. So putting those different little spins on it, both from different locations and maybe putting some power or frequency or what have you conditions on it, just kind of makes it more fun, but it makes it more frequently. If you go to the Yahoo group and take a look at the L Expeditions Atlanta, you'll see that there are quite a number of these things that go on during a given year, enough to kind of keep people on the air so they don't go dormant. Is that a fair statement, Bill?
That's a fairly, yeah, I would say it's a fair statement. And the other part of it, the experimentation part, you know, people look at antennas, and I like messing with antennas. But people look at antennas and they think if you don't pay $300 for it, if it doesn't come in a box, if it isn't engineered by an engineer, then it's, you know, it's junk. And the antenna I use in the park most of the time is essentially a modified 80-meter dipole that I put on electric fence posts, so it's only 3 feet off the ground. And I'll find somewhere I can stretch this thing without people walking over it. And sit there, trying to think of his call sign. KJ4AZA, his name is Richard, had been out of the hobby for a while and he came back in. And he was looking at this antenna and he said, well, what is this? I said, speaker wire. I got it at Radio Shack dump for, you know, $1.99 or something and built this antenna. And in the middle of the antenna at this point was a bottle cap off of a Powerade bottle that I had cut a couple holes in. And it couldn't hang this thing long, but it would support on the pole. And we sat there and worked all through Illinois and Indiana on this thing, you know. And at that point he became interested, but he made the comment. He said, well, I could do that. And I said, that's the whole point. So he is an active ham now, and I think he builds all of his own antennas just based on seeing that it can be done.
Well, let me ask this question. In other words, what this is basically is almost like a impromptu special event station that you're doing. In other words, all of a sudden you just appear, you post somewhere, make an announcement. Doesn't necessarily have to be weeks or days in advance. You know, you just wake up one morning.
It's hours in advance on a couple of occasions.
Yeah, it's partly that. Plus, the things we do in the park are intentionally done to attract attention. We want people to come and see what we're doing. So there's more than one aspect to it. There's also the antenna experimentation that Arnold and I got into. He got me interested in building what I call marginal antennas using 28-gauge wire and a block of wood. And we set it in front of his house or in front of his office one day and worked the Salmon Run up in Washington with 50 watts off of an antenna that basically when we were done, we just wadded up and threw it away. You know, and this particular antenna didn't even have an SO239. We just skinned back the end of the coax and stuck it on there. Now, a new ham looks at something like that and, you know, they think you're nuts. But you see that it actually works. Maybe that will encourage them to try more.
Well, I was wondering how far in advance you notify everybody you're doing this, or can it be just an impromptu thing? You know, all of a sudden you post and a couple hours later you're on the air and making contacts with people, which would be
there are some that basically the guy says I'll be on the radio in an hour. And for those of us who work at home and have stations at home, yeah, we can go hunting for him. If I'm working in an office, I'm not going to see that one. I try to publish 2 weeks in advance if I know the trip's coming up 2 weeks in advance. I think a week is probably more common for a person. The park outings that we do, we basically publish those in all the club newsletters that we have access to a month or two ahead because we know when it's going to be. Then the next one we'll be doing will be on November the 11th or on Memorial Day. I'm sorry.
Now the nice thing about this is you're using this on the Yahoo groups, so that means if you post, there's an email that goes out to all members. Isn't that correct? Isn't that how Yahoo groups work?
Yeah, there's two options to it. You can either get individual emails as the posting occurs, or you can batch them up and get them once a day. And our group, I believe, gets pulled at about between 3 and 3:30.
So the third option is to do no emails and just you make it your point to go to that website, which I do. I'm a member of about 50 groups, so I don't get any email. And so but it's my religion, if you will, to go check these things.
Now you have to forgive me, man. I was trying to do some Googling here to find the site, and I had to get creative. So I ended up putting in Atlanta KB4 KFT, your call sign, and then God. Expedition, and you know, and that's how I found it. You know, the is there an easier?
Well, it's a Yahoo group. So if you go to groups.yahoo.com and look for it, you can find it. I think we've posted enough L Expedition stuff around where if you put in L Expedition Atlanta, it should
find
it.
That's L-X-P-E-D-I-T-I-O-N. L-X, yeah. Just like D Expedition that we hams butchered the English proper, but yeah. L Expedition.
And the Atlanta is important. We don't have an Atlanta Zoo. We have Zoo Atlanta. And our part of town, which is historical, is not called the Atlanta Underground. It's called Underground Atlanta. So L Expeditions Atlanta just seemed to suggest itself. That's why it sounds backwards.
So let me ask this question then. So, I mean, because I'm trying to get the concept down here, and I'm pretty dense, okay? This is, I mean, how would you call, or how would you say that this differs from a special event station?
There are not as many candles on the birthday cake.
I don't know that it does. I mean, maybe I'm not expressing it well, or maybe I'm making it sound too simple when it really is a simple concept. The whole idea behind it, and also the second Sunday technical sessions, which Mike UPO and I started a few years back, is do something. You know, you can go to ham meetings or club meetings or whatever, and you can see presentations and pretty PowerPoints, and you walk out of the room and you forget it in 10 minutes. You know, but if you actually do something, if you go to a park and set up a station running on a battery, running on an antenna that you put up, you're going to remember. And if you get three or four people together, it is a lot of fun. Some people just don't understand that it can be fun until they do it. And I don't understand why the concept is so difficult, but seems to be.
One difference, Ted, from a special event station is that you get a lot of the so-called 599 QSOs, slam, bam, thank you, ma'am, next call.
No.
This is a lot more of a round table-ish culture to it than with the typical special event. That's why I chimed in. What makes this different from a real special event like, say, Navassa or W1AW or something? Is there just not as many candles on the birthday cake?
Well, the reason why I say it is that, you know, special event station can be, you know, it can be anything. I mean, you can go set up a station over here at one of the in Tennessee here, one of our old Civil War forts or something like that, you know, and publish. We got a special event station going, but you're right. It turns into a 599. You're 599 here, you're 599 there. Nobody knows anybody's name. They don't know who you are. They don't know anything about you, your family, your station, or nothing. It's just, you know, that same thing. And that's another thing that just irritates the daylights out of me.
What's the point?
Yeah, I mean, it's like I like to engage somebody and say, hey, you know, how'd you get into this? You know, what kind of rig you running? And tell me, what do you do for a living? You know, you start asking some questions. Of course, I get too far into that, you know, but all I'm saying is that I was wondering how it differed from a D Expedition. Let me ask you this. Could you have a spin like this on it? And maybe this will help grab the concept. Let's just say, for example, that you post that you're going to be set up in a park there in Atlanta somewhere. And then all of a sudden, David here reads that. So then he goes and sets up at a park here. You know, and now do you have multiple people doing this at the same time? Let's say, for example, in the same, you know, genre of locations, or now am I shooting holes in the wall here.
Well, no, I mean, if I posted that I was going to set up, let's say, at Tanyard Creek Park, and he posted, well, I'll just go set up at, Al Blanchard Park, good. I mean, it's had the effect. He's actually doing something. He could just, and sorry, David, he could just shamble upstairs and pick up the mic and go, you know, for a minute and then shamble back downstairs. But I think it's a whole lot healthier to build the radio, put it together, carry it out, and do it somewhere outside. And plus, you get the experience of doing something new. And frankly, people that use their radio from inside all the time are missing a lot of the fun of just being outside and doing this stuff, you know? While Frank was talking, I reached over and picked up a card. September, I went to Tybee Island, and we had an L expedition, and 40-meter band has been all strange up and down. And at about an hour and a half, it just started dropping, so we all 73'd off. And I sat there for a few minutes with the radio on. I had a bottle of water. It wasn't hot, but it was warm. And out of the almost no sound at all came KA9JCP. His name is Ron. He had been listening to us. He heard me mention the name on the air. He went and looked it up. He knew who I was at that point. He and I talked for probably an hour and a half as the band was coming back up. And we talked literally through the up part of the band, and then as it began to die, we dropped off. So the entire L expedition with the group here in Atlanta took about an hour, hour and a half. But here we had a conversation with him and two other guys like you would on a repeater. They just wandered in, chatted for a while, and then wandered out, you know. And I'm trying to think of a picture that works. Maybe in the old days, people sat around the pickle barrel in the store and just talked to whoever came by. Same principle.
Yeah, I was gonna, very good concept. I was going to ask, though, the one thing I could see that this would really be good for, and that is, you know, there's a lot of times we just assume the bands are dead. Do you ever pick a frequency or pick a band that everyone maybe would assume is just, it's just not, you know, this is not optimum time. It must be dead. The sunspot cycle must be screwy. Propagation must be bad. And you pick a frequency, and lo and behold, you find out that there's not a problem at all with the band or the frequency.
I sat one time and called CQ on 40 meters. It had died, and it was just dead quiet. You know how it is when it gets – there's just nothing. And I sat there and called CQ for probably 15 or 20 minutes, and I don't let it set long. Maybe pause for 5 or 10 seconds and do it again. And after that time, this guy come blasting in. He was in Mississippi, and he's the only person I could hear, and he was loud. And again, you know, he was doing the same thing. He was tuning around and just saying, man, there's just nobody out there. And there I was. And we just happened, I guess, to be on the one part of 40 meters that was open at that time. You know, if he had come back in 5 minutes or 5 minutes before, he might not have heard me. But we ended up sitting there talking for a while. As the band went up and down, he would fade out, but we'd stay on frequency. And when it come back up in a few minutes, we'd continue. I like to rag chew. And I agree with you, this whole thing of your 5-9 into Georgia, you know, QRZ, what's the point in that? I'm not a contester. I don't get that mentality. So, but I do get rag chewing.
You know, this is a blend of that, again, sort of brings that culture back into it. It's sort of the doing of ham radio as opposed to the form of it. Go ahead, Ted. I cut you off.
I can't remember what I was going to say. See, I'm getting that age.
it's happening all over. Let me throw in this point. Maybe that'll be a catalyst to you. Another topic we want to talk about, and we don't have to shift there now, but everything that Bill's talking about that he's been involved in with his fellow hams in the Atlanta Radio Club, which is now a century old. It's been there since the beginning of amateur radio, along with the club at the Georgia Institute of Technology. There's this one phrase I heard Bill say when I was in Atlanta, and I have carved it in stone, Bill, and it is the informal slogan for my local club here in the Jackson, Mississippi area. And it's, we do stuff. Now, everything Bill has talked about, one way or another, whether it's L Expedition, whether it's Strange Antenna Challenge, whether it's Tech Sunday, or whether it's, you know, what have you, it's doing ham radio, not just meeting, eating, and talking about it.
And the other thing that I say that I'm sure people are really tired of hearing, so I try not to say it too much. You know, it's a hobby. It's supposed to be fun. If it's not fun, then you're doing it wrong.
Boy, if that's not a mouthful. Get some silence on that.
Was that good or bad? I'm not sure.
Well, no, I mean, one of the things that, you know, one of the things that I've experienced myself in this hobby, and that is trying to introduce someone to it and taking them to a local club meeting and, you know, and having the people talk just the most drab, dull stuff over and over, or flip the radio on and start dialing up and down, and everybody's talking about something that, you know, you just want to go to sleep. You know, there's no, and I don't know. I think that one of the things that we've lost in the hobby with our focus on emergency communications, and God bless emergency communications, we have lost the ability to have fun, to just plain have fun.
Yeah, and it goes back to what I said early on. You know, whenever I meet somebody who's new in the hobby, within the first few minutes, I get the question in, well, you know, what brought you to the hobby? And as soon as they say, well, MCOM, I want to do MCOM, I feel like at that point they're already lost, because they came in for a mundane business type reason, if you can use that phrase, and to them there's no fun to it. You know, they've missed it. So if I can get that person to actually have fun doing something, and also the way we do it, pulling up somewhere and operating off a battery, off a wire that you put up in a tree without a slingshot or anything, you know, basically I just go out with a wire and a 3 ounce fishing weight, that seems to me like it would be perfect preparation for MCOM work.
Oh, because you bet it is, Bill.
If the world comes to an end, you know, you're not going to be using a repeater, and D-Star is not going to be any good, but HF will still be there.
Well, you know, there's one thing, though, and that is this. The effectiveness of emergency communication comes from innovative people. And when I say innovative people, people who can roll with it. You know, I mean, all of a sudden they're throwing something, and instead of them grabbing their manual and starting to go through it, well, what do we do under these circumstances, you know, they just instinctively do something.
Yeah.
You know, and that's what makes it work. Now, you know, you get too serious about all this when we don't have an emergency. I think it limits the thinking. We get very rigid in our thinking. I think, what is it, Frank says that, hams suffer from, you know, hardening of the categories, you know, I really think that's, it becomes a dead weight around your neck, you know, and the guy that's having fun in that state of mind and stays in that state of mind is going to be experimenting and tinkering and all that kind of stuff. And then all of a sudden, the power goes out, and you have all these adverse things going on. That ham is ready to rock and roll, and it's not because he passed an ARRL exam on emergency communication. It's because he just knows instinctively in his gut what to do. And
one of the things that I've noticed, and my views on Aries are well known. They're also misinterpreted. People think I don't like Aries. I actually am a firm supporter of it. I just don't like it when it becomes a political sort of grab at the new members because we need to pad our numbers kind of thing. I've got a friend lives close to me here in Duluth, Georgia. If he gets activated, he's got to drive 15 or 16 miles to his hospital where he works. He passes three hospitals in this county on the way over there. The only reason he's in that group is they wanted to pad their numbers. That seems kind of dumb. And then you go into the central part of Georgia where they don't have a lot of repeaters, and you find that they do some of their sets, you know, some of their practice, no repeater at all, simplex on UHF or VHF. So there's some flexibility in the way they do things. And these are the guys also who are out there, you know, building their own antennas and doing all that stuff. So, you're right. The two go hand in hand. The person that has fun is more likely to be the one who can adapt to something unexpected.
You bet. Let me chime in just briefly. And I've been an emergency coordinator in Starkville, Mississippi. And I've been an ARL division official for several years until just recently. And I've taken some of those exams. And, you know, it does sort of become a business-like thing, Bill. And And some people thrive on that. And we all have the stereotype of the ham with a shack on a belt, and you know, and the cops always say, "Oh, so you're now here? You're gonna help me do my job, right?"
Yeah.
And the joke of that is that there are some hams who would take that seriously and say, "Oh yeah, I'm here to help you now." So we can take many of these things way too far.
The other thing, Frank, and you've been out of the area for a while, but this came up maybe a couple years ago, and I'm not going to mention any names. One of the local Aries groups decided that they would get those ARRL IDs that say on the bottom, not for ID. It doesn't register, but they said, well, if we're going to do that, we might as well be recognizable. And so they decided to get Aries uniforms with patches and everything. You know, and I asked one of the guys, I said, well, you're going to have like a sewn-on badge? He said, absolutely. I said, so if disaster happens, the bad guy's going to look and see some guy walking down the street with the uniform and the badge on, it's going to be you, or you're going to carry a gun. And I think that killed the uniform. I think they finally just sort of gave up on it because it was stupid. I mean, I hate
well,
to say it.
Well, in all seriousness, to use another Southern term, Bill, there are actual badges that state EMAs give people that jump through enough of those hoops.
That's
now, I want to give them their due. I mean, I have had a security clearance. I have been through NSA screenings at least twice, and so on and so on. So I respect that. But you know, there's a plurality out there. We've got over 730,000 licensed hams. Now, just because some of them are dead, I don't hold that against them. That is, their licenses haven't faded away yet. But we got to have fun. This is a hobby, and we can have it as a hobby in service. And one of the things I've observed is a lot of the Aries groups around here are fairly serious in that they get together. It's a little bit like your L Expedition concept, but they do more of what I call public service. All these charity races, they provide yep. communications, local police departments. They just don't have the overtime to do any of that. We don't direct traffic or anything. And it's a party, but it's a party that we celebrate what we can do and what the race organizers can't and don't want to do.
Right.
And it's fun, and it's still fun. And there's a lot of this sort of throwing a wire over a tree and the camaraderie and those things.
Are you in Mississippi right now?
I am in Ridgeland, Mississippi, on the banks of the Barnett Reservoir. And I look out one window and I see the moon.
I've noticed shining. That the emergency people in the south part of the country that are in the track of these hurricanes and whatnot tend to take it a lot more seriously, but they don't tend to get regimented like we're talking about. And exactly what you say. They practice all the time, but they practice different things.
Right. Right. Well, the fun thing, and I think Ted's picked up on this as well, that is key, because I want to segue just a little bit. We can come back to any of these topics, but I want to talk a little bit about clubs and leadership. Now, the Atlanta Radio Club is at least 100 years old. It's probably 100 and change now, and I'll give full disclosure. I am a continuing dues-paying member and very proud to be a member of the Atlanta Radio Club. And W4DOC, the repeater system, and it probably has changed now, but Ted, that repeater system, if you look on QRZ and EHAM and some of the other websites that talk about repeaters and things, that's been noted as one of the repeater systems that has not paled into oblivion with no traffic. When I was living an hour north of Atlanta and having a two-hour-a-day commute, that was just like a friend in the car with me. And it's still active, and you can echo link into it. And sometimes I do and listen. So, Bill, you have been president at least a couple of times. I think you're currently vice president. How do you keep a club like the Atlanta Radio Club keep on keeping on as a leader?
The short answer is I don't have a clue. Our club is in a stranglehold situation because we're in Metro Atlanta. We're actually inside what we call the perimeter. We're downtown. All of our members basically fled to the suburbs 20 years ago. So attracting new members is a little hard because they have to fight rush hour traffic to get down to us. And Atlanta does have the reputation, and it's not warranted, but they have the reputation of being very dangerous down there. I've I've never had any problems, and I've lived here coming up on 27 years or so. When I first got pushed into being president, I actually joined the club, and here's what happened. I don't know how much time we got. I don't want to run you guys out.
You got plenty of time. You got plenty of time. So
okay, I joined the club and paid my $22 and went to a meeting and went to a meeting and went to about five meetings. Nobody ever recognized me as a new member. Nobody ever recognized me as an old member, and I had to go find out whether I was actually a member or not, because nobody, I never, you know, even the cable company will say thank you for your payment. They didn't do that. So I had intended to walk away from the club figuring, you know, if I'm not wanted, I'll go. That's sort of my thing. A group of the members got together and said, you know, they were looking at the L expeditions and they were looking at Sunday sessions that we did independently. They were looking at the Strange Antenna Challenge. And they basically pushed me into being president. At that time, my job was to walk into IT projects that were either failing or had failed and figure out how to either rescue the project or flush it as painlessly as possible. So I basically, when I came into it, I treated it the same way. I said, you know, we have certain tasks that we have to do that are expected of a club, and there's some other things we can do that would be nice. Let's just see how I can push people along and get it working. They had not done a field day probably in 10 years, so we did the first field day. It was an utter disaster, but it wasn't because of planning. It was some other things. I reached out and went to the Georgia Tech Club and said, you know, we're the two oldest clubs in the state. We should do something together. And we actually worked out a cooperative effort. The main thing was a club is defined by its activities. If they're not doing something, if they're not doing outings, or they're not having special interest groups on electronics, or they're not, if the club is not doing something, it's circling the drain. So all I did, as simple as that, was come up with things that we could do. And basically we took the outing concept and started doing an outing a month. Field day, we do the Georgia CUSO party, was a big outing. The first year we did that, we had 50 people show up for it. The first field day that they had done in 10 years, we had about 50 show up for that too. People are interested in doing things. The club just has to put it out there for them. There's no trick to it. That's all there is.
We do stuff. That's, to me, what you're saying.
Yeah. I mean, if I want to go to a lecture, I can sit here at home and bring up the computer and watch, you know, iTunes or whatever and watch all the lectures I want. The meetings, it's okay to have a lecture as long as there's some, you know, educational thing behind it. But then there's all the other parts you have to have, you know. And this club, the Atlanta Club, because I like doing outings, I pushed it that direction. There's another club that likes doing kit builds and that kind of thing. That's what they're working on. They have three or four kit builds, I don't know, maybe one a month or so. Every club has a personality. You just have to figure out what that personality is and then play to it. That's all there is.
I've got a question, Ted. In regards to, and this may be something, too, that Frank can jump in and add to. One of the things that I saw that is very difficult to deal with in terms of clubs, and this has been an ongoing thing that I've observed. I've really never been a part of it from the standpoint of participation, but I've stood at a distance and watched it and just scratched my head. And that is, how do you handle a group of people when you have, say, two or three folks that literally want to commandeer and just take the thing over? And if the membership is relatively passive and they kind of go along with it, then you start watching your membership dwindle because it's being controlled by two or three people that are operating outside of what you would consider to be popular vote. You know, and I'm big on this because working in radio, you learn very quickly that if you don't do the things people want to hear, you don't have an audience. And I think the same thing would hold true with a club. In other words, if you're not doing the things that people really enjoy doing and you're being driven by two or three people who are driven for whatever their reasons are, then pretty soon the club is going to dwindle too. So my question is, how do you handle that? Because that would be a real stickler for me. I wouldn't do well in those situations.
That and that's partially, and again, I got to be careful because a lot of the people that I could put in that category are actually good club members. But that's kind of what was happening with the Atlanta Club when I first came, or I first got pushed into it. You know, the club wasn't actually doing anything. There were three or four people that were driving it, and I asked one time. I said, "How come we haven't done this, that, the other?" And he said, "Well, I've already done that." You know, couple that with absolutely just ignoring the new members that come in. Now, by contrast, at this same time, I had joined the North Fulton Amateur Radio League. It's a suburb out here north of us near Roswell. And I remember it well. And if he's listening to this in the podcast, something he'll know. But Jim Stafford, when I walked in the door, I said, "Is this the meeting?" And Jim Stafford walked over and grabbed my hand and shook it, introduced himself. He introduced the other people there. And he said, "Here, let me get you a chair." You know, they made it clear that I was welcome there. So one of the things I did when I realized that I was going to have to do this is I made sure that everybody that walked in the room got spoken to. And if it was somebody that we didn't recognize, I made sure that they knew that it was okay to talk. Don't sit back there hunkered over afraid to say anything. So I'd actually start talking to them, joking with them as soon as they come in the door, if I didn't. The pushers, the guys who are sort of manipulating the club around, going back to my management days, I handled them the same way I would if I had an employee in a new group that I was building who wanted to take over. There's two ways to do it. You either give them more than they can handle or you chase them off. And in my case, I just gave them more than they can handle. And of course, they failed. The task they failed at, I gave to somebody else who got the reward of actually doing it when somebody else couldn't. So they got an extra buzz out of it. And the guys who wanted to take over realized that maybe taking over is not what they really wanted to do. So a couple of them got mad and left, were gone for 6 or 7 months, and then came back. In the first 2 years, we doubled the size of the club.
How big is the club, Bill?
It's hovering about 100 right now. We were, when I left the second term, up to 189, I think.
Wow. That's clearly one of the larger clubs in the U.S. Now, you have to keep in mind, Ted, the Atlanta Radio Club is one of about, what, a dozen clubs that are in the Atlanta metro area?
There's two big clubs and three or four smaller ones, and we're nestled somewhere in the middle.
There, but you take the 20-county area and clubs like Walton Clan, I mean, you know, you've probably got that many. One thing that I'm picking up on that is a subtlety, hams come from every walk of life with every type of experience, and yet, you know, one member, one vote, a democracy. So it's a volunteer organization. We have very little leadership training to become a leader in that group. Now, if someone comes in like Bill or like someone else who's had management training, then, you know, they've had preparation. And you may have sort of Joe Sixpack Ham come in and, you know, they've had none. So you have a garden variety of leaders that emerge. A subtlety that many leaders don't consider is it's not their club. That when you're a leader, you're probably less of a member.
You're a servant.
Exactly. That's my punchline. You are serving those members, or you should be. Hence the North Fulton Club, Jim Stafford coming and served you.
That's right.
Not to get biblical too much here, but just like in a church, if you go to a church and nobody speaks to you, then you may or may not come back. And so
I remember that as being one of the best memories that I have in ham radio the early days, because it was clear that I was welcome there. Everybody walked in that room, you know, and I did go to meetings for a while. Now, once I started really getting involved at the Atlanta Radio Club as a management level, if you want to call it that, I sort of dropped away from the other clubs and quit going to them. One of the things, like you just said, Frank, that I always drove home to the board, you know, if you want to rule, if you want to be a small king, then that's fine. It's much better to be a servant, because if you are a servant, you can get people to do things for you.
Exactly. Now, so you've had between 100 and 190 members over your period. Roughly what's your bank account like?
I'm not going to talk about that on the radio.
Well, without.
I'm surprised you'd even bring it up. Come on. We have a trust fund that is fairly large that has been left, has been building essentially since the 60s. We tapped into it to build the new repeater system. And Stephen Slider, KG4PTO, is the new repeater manager. Basically, the plan was to rebuild it from the ground up. And we've been slowly progressing one step at a time, add one piece, make sure it's stable, and move on. That whole upgrade, we reached in and pulled out, I think, $15,000 in reserve out of the trust fund. In operational funds, it's not as much as you would think.
Well,
it doesn't have to be.
Here's where I'm going. Not to try to, inadvertently put you on the spot, but when you file
the form. Already have.
Listen, he does this to guests all the time. He puts them on the spot, and then later he'll try to blame me for it, but go ahead.
Listen, friend, you're 501c3, correct?
Yes.
And by getting that tax-exempt status, sir, you owe the public a disclosure on a Form 990 to the IRS every year, right?
Do we do that? Is that what you're asking?
Oh, I don't know whether you do or not, and I personally, it doesn't matter. Here's my point. Some of that's already public information, just to leave your, Here's my point. Most clubs, what's that metaphor? There's a pot. Let's see, there's some metaphor there where you don't have much. Most clubs don't have anything. And so what I'm really getting into, Bill, was not so much to get into the nuances of the Atlanta Radio Club's finances, but you have resources. Most clubs don't have any.
Our finances are public. We're supposed to do a treasury report every 3 months about what's in trust and what's in cash. Every time when I was in office and we talked about spending anything more than, and honestly, I know that I did, and I think Bert did, and I know that Rob did, the other three guys, if we needed something that was $30 or $40, we just paid for it. We didn't go through the whole thing.
Anyway,
I was up doing a presentation at a club in Chattanooga for the Strange Antenna Challenge 3 or 4 years ago, and my presentation was going to be after the club business. This was in, I think, October, maybe. And he said, we need to do business first. Okay. I said, sure. They had $287 in the bank and was planning a Christmas party.
Right.
And the guy made a comment. He said, we need to get some more members if we're going to get a turkey. Or it was something to that effect.
Right.
From that point on, when I got into club office, I thought of every expenditure in the number of club members we either spend in their money or we have to acquire new ones.
Right.
That's how I manage the finances.
Now, here's the punchline I'm getting at.
Okay.
You've got between 100 and 190 members over your tenure.
Right.
And you have some money. Now, see, that by itself puts that leadership requirement into a slightly different category than the garden variety club, because the biggest problem is like the one in Chattanooga. Hey, we've got to have Santa Claus come for a visit and donate a turkey, or we've got to go recruit some more members.
Right.
And one of the reasons for that is that in my sort of sense of things from talking to people around the country is that they don't look at a club as a business. Okay. It's a hobby, but yet this is a club that's serving our interest in that hobby.
Right.
And so my point in saying all that is when you have some resources to be able to do stuff, it makes life a lot more palatable. And that's my whole point is that as a leader, you have looked at it as serving others, not others serving you.
Yeah, it needs the club leadership is a misnomer. The people at the top, let's say, are managing the club resources, the bank account, the goodwill, which is also one, also managing the meetings. They are servants to the rest of the club. If they end up with bad leadership, well, that's the leadership the club wanted. You can't fault them for that. Our revenue streams, and again, going back to my roots in IT, our revenue stream is the dues that people pay each year plus the money we make from the Hamfest. And we're doing okay on that. We do have the resources. If we need to go buy banners, we go buy banners. The outings in the parks, field day, Georgia CUSO party outings, for the last Georgia CUSO party outing, I went and bought 6 pizzas. That's a total of $42 out of my pocket. What did it cost the club? Nothing. Absolutely nothing.
See, that's the kind of thing that goes on in a grassroots volunteer club. There are people who pay for stuff just because they want to, because it adds to the mix.
Yeah.
But one thing,
and that's part of what doing stuff is about.
I was a host. I saw myself, and in a lot of these events, people laugh, but in a lot of them, you know, I may bring two radios. They both become go-to stations. I may not even touch a radio other than to show somebody how to use it, make zero contacts during the day. It's a joke. But, I mean, it's a joke amongst the group. I go to every one of these. I've never made a contact. But I see my role there as a host. You know, you go ahead and play radio, and you do what you need to. I'll be the one greeting the people walking up. You know, or if anybody else is there, I'm not saying I take it exclusively. But I feel that my role there is a host, not only for the club members, but for people that may walk up.
Let me say something here about where Frank was going. I think that it only demonstrates the success of amateur radio and the intent of radio amateurs when a club does have resources and something comes up and you say, well, you know what? We want to throw some money in that pot over there. We want to sponsor this. We want to buy a radio for whatever this is over here. You know, in other words,
and we've done that.
But you have to have the resources to do it, you know, and I think that was one thing that maybe in the process of talking about all this, maybe got missed, because I think I know where Frank was going, and that is, if you don't have some free resources, and then, you know, maybe it's even better the deeper the pockets are, because then at some point in time, maybe you can help out some young hams, some group of young hams. You may put on a class of some sort, and in the process of that, you guys might wind up buying some radios, or, you know, and as it's done as a club activity, it just makes the club look all that bad, or that good, I should say, and it also, you know, builds the image of amateur radio. It makes us look like the benevolent group of people that we're supposed to be. I don't know. Is that making sense?
No, it makes absolute sense. And we have bought equipment. According to the law, we can't give it away, but we can loan it indefinitely. So we have loaned equipment to Skywarn here in Atlanta. It caused quite a controversy, but it was the right thing to do. We put money every year into the local Makers Fair. Several of the clubs get together and have a fairly large booth. It's actually won first prize a few years in a row. Yes, and the thing is, if we have an event come up and only one ham, one club member is interested in it, then we got to look at it a little bit closer. But if there's enough members interested in doing it, it's their money. And we're just watching their money for them.
Well, so, it is, and donations to your group though also benefit the donor, because it's a tax deductible donation.
Right. The other aspect, and this is the one I've been complaining about a little bit, is we handle estate sales for the club. If somebody dies, if they are a club member, that's good. If they're not, we do it anyway. And the club keeps none of it. Some of the clubs keep 10% or 15% or half or something. Because we do have pockets like that, we can afford to say, if I get $100 for this, I'll send $100 to family. And the standing joke I have right now is I have more dead people stuff in my house than my stuff. And that sounds like a joke, but it actually is true. I've got like, you'd have to see my living room. My living room looks like the last scene in the first Indiana Jones movie.
You know, I was going to say something. You mentioned something that I think is so key. And we have to talk about it, because I've said this before. Hams, for the most part, are, and that includes all of us, you know, none of us are immune, tend to be very, very socially challenged individuals. I mean, it's a shame, but that's just the way it works out. And I know you've seen it. You've probably been at a field day somewhere where you had two or three people that were just as rude as all get out. They didn't mean to be rude. It's just their nature. Yeah. You know. But anyhow, when people come to a club meeting, we need to train hams that are members of clubs to run over to that person that walked in that they don't know. Don't turn to your neighbor and go, who is that? I don't think I ever saw him before. Where did he come from? You know, walk over and ask. Say, hey, I don't think I've ever met you. My name is so-and-so. My call sign is this. Welcome to the meeting tonight. You know,
yep.
In other words, don't depend on, you know, well, who is that? I don't think I ever saw him before. You know, that's basically the wrong approach, but saying hello. But the most, I would have to say, one of the biggest assets that we have And that is if clubs in areas have local repeaters and you hear a call sign on. People move into an area, they get on the repeater, and the first thing they need to hear coming from this community is, hey, we got our club meeting next Tuesday evening. Why don't you come join us? We'd love to meet you. You know,
I agree.
But to contrast that, when I moved here into this area, David, are you still with me here?
Huh? What?
Yeah, he's not doing anything over there.
Yeah. Well, and David will tell you, we were on the local repeater here in town, jumped on it, and the purpose of getting on it was really and truly was to kind of make ourselves known and talk to some other folks here in the area, get acquainted and whatnot. And the first thing I got is I got a curmudgeon. And Mr. Curmudgeon come out of the woodwork, this repeater is for, we'd like to designate it for people from out of town. So if you could get off this machine and talk on simplex. So I said to the guy, I said, well, I mean, out of town, originally I'm from Detroit. Does that count? You know, he didn't have any sense of humor at all. He wanted me off the machine.
It's a shame to see that repeater pair wasted that way.
Well, see, that's what I'm saying. So I think that when we talk about self-policing, I think one of the things we have to do is we have to self-police against unfriendliness. I think that's one of the major things. We got to look for unfriendliness and go to that guy and say, look, that's not the way you behave. You don't behave like that. Okay. Didn't your mama teach you anything? You know, maybe in a very nice way, reprimand them, but tell them you don't do that, you know? And I've heard it. I've watched it. I've seen it. It's like epidemic. Really, in some areas. Other areas, it's not. There's none of it goes on. Everybody's friendly and everybody gets along. Everybody has a lot of fun. But in some,
I think it, go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt. I thought you were finished. In the Atlanta area, I don't think we have that. The clubs here are in sort of a friendly competition with one another. But I haven't heard what you're talking about on the Atlanta machines, except for one person on D-Star who. Basically, as soon as you come up and throw your call sign out, when he hears it, he'll come on and say, we're reserving this machine, to which my way of thinking is, why don't you just power it down? You know, you're using up electricity and you're eating up a pair that we could use for something else, you know. But that's just, I mean, he owns the machine and that's the way he wants to run it. And I can tell you that it is, if it's not formally reserved, it's awful quiet because nobody goes there.
Well, I think what has to happen in areas like that, and I don't know what the legality is, but amateurs in the community need to get together and write a letter to the commission and request the machine shut down because it's not operating in the interest of amateur radio and the general public. You know,
here's Ted. I can tell you the answer to that. I served for about 6 months on the designated coordinating body in the Southeast, SARA. Bill's in a state that participates in SARA. Now, the FCC don't want to be bothered with that.
No.
And so what they've done is they've entered into an MOU, and the ARL filed a friend of the court sort of statement that said, we will not be involved in frequency coordination. Because remember, Cardinal Rule, Part 97, who owns a frequency? No one owns a frequency. So the National Frequency Coordinating Council, which is a nonprofit corporation in Minnesota, the president is Mike or Mark Stinnett in Texas. And they are the group empowered to do nothing but recognize bodies who coordinate frequencies in local areas. And I have to phrase it that way because, you know, you may have like West Virginia that has more than one frequency coordinating group. And part of that's due to conflict. So if your frequency coordinating body is supposed to follow certain standards that the NFCC has set down that are consistent with the commission's opinion about this, and they are supposed to try to make the best use of the resource. Now, do you have to coordinate a repeater? No. However, if you're on a frequency pair that you interfere with a coordinated repeater, then basically the tie goes to the runner, as in baseball, and the coordinated frequency pair can accuse you legitimately of causing interference if you're on that right. frequency. Now, in 2 meters, you know, we're like the Bronx or Brooklyn. I mean, you're stacking apartments up high in the sky, not out. And 2 meters is pretty tough, particularly in metro areas. Is that pretty true in Atlanta? It's hard. It'll be difficult to get a 2 meter pair.
It's impossible at this point. There are none left, but there are groups that basically at one time had 5, 6, 10 repeaters, had a bunch of repeaters. They were a repeater club. That's all they did. Mm-hmm. And when they went under, they basically pulled the equipment, and those are what they call paper machines.
Yes.
They don't actually, they're not on the air, but the frequencies are tied up until their license drops. I would love to see this town come up with about 15 or 20 new pairs, but it's not going to happen. Well, 440's hopping.
What Sarah has tried to do with that is require this annual or biannual.
Every year, yeah.
Every year renewal, and yet what people do is they tend to renew that. Now, in Mississippi, the director, I was vice director before I stepped back, there were some other issues about how Sarah operates that gave me pause, and I'll leave it at that. But what he wanted to do was to have three of us go ride the circuit and actually go key up these machines. Well, you know, gas was about $4 a gallon at the time, and I just kind of didn't see, you know, me being one bullet Barney with, you know, my mobile rig and doing that. So it's a struggle, Ted. I mean, to be honest, it's a struggle. And you have hit the golden rule, you know, we need to treat others as we wish to be treated.
But what I see, though, is I see people, like, for example, I don't believe there should be closed repeaters. I don't think there should be, they should be allowed. The frequencies do not belong to individuals for their own selfish interest.
I agree with that. I see a closed repeater. I wonder what are those people doing, number one, and why are they special?
You know, I mean, that's the first thing. So, I'm automatically 180 degrees out of phase with closed repeaters. The second thing is when somebody puts a machine on the air and appoints themselves Adolf Hitler, okay, and we have the Third Reich Repeater Association, okay,
called the trustee, right?
I really believe the local radio amateurs have a right in that area. And if they want to bring people in from local media, they want to bring people in from the local community, and I believe they have a right, they should have a right to go petition the FCC and say, get this thing off the air. The frequency is valuable. We could use that frequency. And Adolf, somebody needs to cut off his mustache, okay, because he ain't got any right to do this. And I'd be very strong about this. I mean, I really do. I think that there should be a method of cutting through the red tape. And you got these organizations and these committees and all this kind of stuff, and 90% of the people that belong to them are members because they've either been thrown out of their local church for being Adolf Hitler, or they have no other way on earth to express themselves as being important in a community. And I don't know. You can see where my opinion's going in all this, you know.
Frank pushed this, me being on tonight in the Atlanta area, I can tell you that there will be two CIRA people, it's Southeast Repeater Association for the folks who aren't in Southeast. There'll be two of them that will listen to it, or either listen to it now or will hear it when it comes up as a podcast. So you have just spoken almost directly to at least two of the guys that can make what you said happen if they want to.
Hi, well, John.
No, really, because we have a hobby here that I think the success or failure in the image of the hobby on the air. You know, I Sea Crane Company is now producing a radio. I don't know if you guys have seen this thing. I've got two of them in here that Bob Crane sent me. They're AM, FM, and 2 meters.
Wow.
So that's not a weather radio. It's an AM, FM, 2 meter radio that Sea Crane is selling that is for the sole purpose of the general public being able to listen to amateur radio. And there's a lot of people that really want to do that, okay? So the last thing we need, you know, on the air is this, you know, Adolf Hitler attitude. You know, let me say this too, and let me kind of branch off here just a little bit in another direction. I like to tell this story because it's true. I was on my way through the Nashville area, and I had the 6.7 machine on. And evidently there was some weather going on, and they had called the WeatherNet. Somebody called the WeatherNet. But after the guy called the WeatherNet, he went silent. He was silent for 15 minutes, didn't hear a thing. So some guy comes in and drops his call sign. You know, he says, oh, this is WB8PUM listening. And all of a sudden, Adolf Hitler Jr. grabs the microphone and says, there's a WeatherNet in progress, old man. We're only accepting check-ins. Like that, you know. Of course, you hear the person kind of cower away, you know. It's kind of like, whoa, so sorry, you know. Yep. Well, then this guy that's running this net, he goes silent again for another 8 or 9 minutes. And somebody else checks in. Matter of fact, it was a mobile from Kentucky coming in into the Nashville area, and he just happened to throw his call sign out. And, man, he got his head completely bit off and chewed up. You know, WeatherNet in progress here. Rah, 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 rah. You know, and I thought, well, you know, if you're going to do this, then why don't you ID about every 2 minutes and say, you know, this is such and such. We have a WeatherNet in progress. You know, weather check-ins are welcome or whatever. Or, you know, no check-ins are welcome. This is my machine. Okay.
Yeah.
You know, whatever, you know. But this went on, and I got so irritated about it, I wrote the guy an email. And, oh, my God, you should have seen what he wrote me back. He said, I'm from Detroit. This is how we do it in Detroit. I said, I was born and raised in Detroit, and I've never heard anybody as rude as you are, okay? Yeah, this doesn't belong on the air. What is wrong with you? Did your mother drop you on your head, you know?
That was just poor net control operatorship.
Yeah, in my second year in office, W4DOC can be commandeered by everybody says the National Weather Service, but it's not. It's a bunch of amateur radio guys call themselves Skywarn that basically report to the NWS. And that's an important distinction because they're just amateurs like everybody else. But we had a storm blow through here, and I remember the date. It was March 13th. It's a Friday in 2010. And I got an email from somebody, and again, no names here, as president of the club, telling me that I needed to chastise a couple of our members because their operator wanted to bring a net up and we wouldn't release the frequency to him. So I went to the guilty party in this thing, and I said, what happened? And he said, well, I said something to the effect of, well, we need to move off. Give us a second to move over to the other machine, the Matt Park machine. And are you going? I'm going. Boom, boom, boom. 15 seconds, they're gone, right? I'm supposed to chastise our members because they didn't show proper respect to this moron. You all can't see me. I'm getting mad already. The guy sent this email to me demanding, sort of demeaning, you know, you work for us and you do, I snap my fingers and you jump kind of thing. And then he blocked his email so I couldn't respond to it. The outcome is now that they are super polite to our people because I made it clear we'll be good hosts as long as you be good guests. And good guest means you know how to operate and you know how to do it correctly, and you unlink when you're done. They would link up and leave the machines linked for 10 or 15 hours.
Wow. Know?
That's Bill, a bad Bill, operator.
Here's something that many Aries, et cetera, and that would include the Skywarn people too. If you take a look around, and I haven't done a formal survey, but I have asked a lot, how many of the Aries teams actually own their own repeater system?
I know of one.
Not that many.
I know of one.
And so one of the things I've pushed here in Mississippi, we're building an intertie, the Magnolia intertie, and we're lighting up I-20 by the end of 2015, and then we'll move up I-55 north and south, et cetera, and build it that way. Well, one of the key things is, you know, Aries said, oh, well, this is going to be for us. Well, no, not necessarily. Yeah, well, it's got to be because we're Aries. Well, yeah. Well, wait a minute.
It's an attitude problem.
You bet it is. And I started asking people, well, if it's that important to you, how many Aries chapters have their own repeater? And there's only two that I know of. And one is in a city east of us on I-20. And my hat's off to them because they've gone down their pockets and they've built their own stuff. And I guess where I'm getting at Ted, and this comes back to it, you've got that yin and yang of somebody puts up a repeater. Well, I vote with you guys on it being closed. I mean, unless it's just a really, really, really good reason that we're not thinking of that we would all agree to. You know, it probably ought to be open just in the spirit of no one owns that frequency pair. But at the same time, we do have things like directed nets. It should be done properly. The net control operator should ID and should let people know so that people like you, Ted, kind of innocently just check in. You know, they don't have the hammer drop on them. And those people that are begging and borrowing should probably always acknowledge the grace given by the owner of the repeater, you know, to keep that up. Ted, I'm like you and Bill. I could go get my hammer out and go bash some heads in a given circumstance. But in the long run, what do we do? Do we go out and do the Wolf Hong approach by our ultimate mentor? Or do we simply choose to act better ourselves? And I would submit that us choosing to act differently will marginalize those curmudgeons more effectively than beating them over the head, although that would be a lot more fun.
Let me say this. If you beat them over the head, there's nothing to damage. Okay, so you're just wasting your time.
Okay? Point well taken.
Now, the other thing is I see a weather net as being one of the best public relations tools to entice new hams on the air, especially if they're just monitoring or listening to the VHF frequency, UHF frequency. Absolutely. But also though, it's a great public relations tool to pull hams into ARES where they haven't participated. They're new. They don't know anything about it. They're curious, you know, and so there you have it. If somebody happens to be, you know, you've called a weather net and some guy just drops his call sign, he's, you know, coming into town out of Kentucky, he has no idea, you know, that there's actually a weather net in progress or something, then why not be courteous and explain that to him and invite him to participate, you know, rather than just chew him up one side and down the other. And that guy, once again, like I said, you take a hammer. And if you were to start bashing, you wouldn't find any brains to bash. I mean, they're not there. I mean, he clearly demonstrated that on the air. But
I keep cutting you off. I think there's a delay here somewhere. One of the cool things, you know, to put credit where credit is due, the Gwinnett Amateur Radio Society, they call themselves GARS over here, they are serious about their ARES. They're well-organized. And they take it, I think, the correct way. It's not that ARES drives everything. You know, ARES is the only purpose. When we have severe weather, they basically start their own net. And that's what I listen to, not the National Weather Service, because one of the members will come on and say, I'm at the corner of Pleasant Hill and Route 20, and it's hailing. Well, I know where that is. To listen to the National Weather Service, and my perfect example was there was a guy came on there doing one of the weather nets, and he said, man, the wind is blowing awful hard out here, and the operator said, where are you? He said, I'm 10 miles outside Bainbridge. What good does that do anybody?
With the way we have things linked and all this stuff, getting reports has to pass what I call the umbrella test. You know, you read in the paper, the print media, and you can see state weather forecast.
Right.
Well, it doesn't do anybody any good. Do I need my umbrella or not? And that's what you need to know.
Right.
And I'm reminded of my good friend who got a big satellite dish. He and his wife moved out in the woods. He got one of those huge satellite dishes, and his name is Mike. And Mike came home, and he saw the forecast for the worst blizzard on record in Starkville, Mississippi. You know, that's where he was. So he goes to Walmart and loads up his Toyota pickup truck, and he just loaded for bear, gets home. His wife, Sherry, comes in and says, Mike, what's all this done in the kitchen? Haven't you paid attention to the weather? We've got the worst blizzard in history coming here. Where did you say that? Well, I saw it on the satellite TV. Well, what station? Well, it was ABC. She said, Mike, we get ABC from Buffalo, New York.
Oh, boy. Yeah. I'll tell you, I think that this program or idea or concept that you've come up with here, excuse me, is really unique. And it's kind of interesting because I see a parallel to what my son David was doing, except the point David never announced where he was going to be or never told anybody. He just went out to the park and set up.
Yeah.
And people would gather around and watch him. Matter of fact, David, tell a little bit about this. And then if you would, Bill, kind of elaborate on what you could add to it or the different ways or different things you could do. Because I know, see, we've got people listening. Excuse me.
I thought I died over here.
No, we've got people listening that, and this is the thing about radio listeners. You know, they don't live and die on our every word. Okay, they listen while they're doing something else, and sometimes folks don't catch the whole concept, and you know, they like to hear something repeated again. But this is such a unique idea. This is such a door opening idea. This is such a, you know, it's almost like a let's get these guys involved and get them busy using their radios so they can have fun. And that's what happens. A lot of times we don't operate and we sit and we mildew, you know, and we need something to a catalyst. You know, to get us going and to get the blood going through the veins and the blood pressure up and the heart beating and all those kind of things. And so I see this as being a really cool idea. But, David, talk a little bit about what you did. And then, Bill, I want you to kind of elaborate as to how a person can carry this a little bit further.
Well, you know, my thing was, it had two purposes. First and foremost, it was to wear the child out. You know, I would take my son out to the park, and I would just stay out there until he was tired and told me it was time to go home. You know, so to scave off the boredom, I guess you could say, I started taking my little HF rig with me, and again the portable radio. I would detach the battery out of my vehicle, go put it on the picnic table, and I'd look to see if there was any contest going on, so that I had something to tune into and maybe hit one of them up. But I ended up calling CQ. And a lot of the time, people would come back to me. But I was doing QRP, so it was only like 5 watts. But still, I had a really good response. You know, people just walking around and whatnot. A lot of the kids would come by and they'd listen, and that's where the contest came in really good. I loved it when there was a lighthouse thing going on. You'd hear the guy talking about the lighthouse and giving the story and whatnot and all that stuff. And
can I ask a question here?
Yes, sir.
Did you have fun?
Oh, I had a lot of fun.
So what's the problem?
Well, there's no problem with it. You know, I need to go out and do it again. You know,
you've got one problem. You got one problem here. You took the battery out of your car. I carry an FT-100D most of the time. I have a woman's cosmetic bag that has the radio, the tuner, the coax, 4 or 5 antennas. I use a 35-amp-hour battery, weighs about 10 pounds, and can operate that radio for at least, well, at field day, we ran the radio continuously until about 9 p.m. before the battery started to suffer, and that was a lot of calling of CQ. So smaller battery is the only thing I can see. Other than that, you've got it down. You know, take your radio out, let the kids go play. Kid run the radio, set up public, go. And you had fun. That's what counts.
You didn't interrupt a WeatherNet, did you?
But I'll tell you, though, it would have been – it really would have been nice to have had been a part of your Yahoo group. That way, when I was going out, I could have said, hey, I'm heading out to so-and-so. And there would – I don't know if you'd want to call it some ringers, but you already pretty much have some guaranteed contacts. And at least –
you've loaded the pond. Loaded the pond to some degree, yeah.
And that does. That really helps out because it is. It's you're sitting there. You're tuning around trying to find somebody. You're calling CQ, and if nobody's there, it's sometimes hard for you to continue to keep the interest of the stranger who's sitting across the table from you, listening to you just say the same thing for 10 minutes. Having the pond loaded is definitely a great idea there.
a lot of times at the park, when we have a park outing, I always, when I write the advertisement up, I make sure and mention, you know, if you're a new ham, here's a chance to see what, you know, HF's all about. If you're a seasoned ham, here's a chance to get on the air for a while. I make sure that everybody, you know, if anybody comes, will end up with a radio. I usually carry two or three in the car with me. It's always annoying to me to sit with a new ham and say, okay, now here's what you do, boom, 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 and then nobody answers. There was a special event station on 2 weeks ago when we were at Tanyard Creek, and one of the young men there, he's got his license, but he had never been on the air. So I said, well, let's work the special event station. I figured, you know, he can get that. I mean, that's not like you're looking for anybody. He's there. So we went through probably 15 minutes of me explaining to him how you establish the rhythm, and you get the rhythm. This guy, you get, you know, QRZ, and he waits a certain amount of time and he answers, and you want to make sure you get it, you know, sort of play the mind game and figure out where he is. He had a ball doing that, but he had to call like 10 times. But he finally got him. If he had called 10 times CQ into dead air and got nothing back, his experience would not have been as good as it was when he made his first HF contact. So, yeah, the L Expedition thing is like loading the pool. There'll be somebody on that frequency. They may not be able to hear you, and you may not be able to hear them, but I guarantee you, as many people as watch that L Expedition Atlanta group, somebody will be sitting out there listening.
I think that's really key to it, because you're right. You know, the sitting there and having a goal. You know, like you said with the gentleman. You know, he could have sat there and tried 10 times, but at least he had a goal. He knew he could hear it. And he could, okay, you know, let's just keep trying, and he'll eventually hit me.
So are you going to start your own group?
Well, I'm just going to piggyback on yours.
No. You know, that's kind of what Bill is sort of trying to do. Not that, you know, you wouldn't be welcome to piggyback on his. But, you know, L Expedition Nashville. I mean, Nashville's a large city. You've got a lot of hams there. In fact, the very first ham that I ever saw in person was actually younger than me. He actually lives in Nashville, and he owns a business that makes prosthetic limbs. And his name is Mike Holmes. And so, you know, you've got hams there that David, you could do this, and you might be surprised at how quickly it takes off.
It's definitely a really good idea, and it does. It you know, and it helps promote the hobby as well. You know,
it's not a lot of hard work. I mean, if people are having fun, you'll find that you just have to provide a playground and they'll go. I've sort of backed off on it the last year or so because I was so involved with the club. But now that I'm out of club politics, and I mean politics with a capital P, I intend to pour some more energy back into this, maybe come up with a ball cap or some sort of insignia. I don't know. It sounds kind of silly. It sounds kind of formal. But I'm going to refer to it, and have been referring to it, as a non-club club. No members, no dues, no resources. You know, we just have a meeting place.
Well, Bill, I want to compliment you because I got this from you, but the Central Mississippi Amateur Radio Association that I'm a vice president for programming of, our informal slogan is hashtag we do stuff, and that came directly from you.
Okay. I tend to spout off a lot, so if you say I said that, I'll take your word for it.
Oh, you did. Ted, are you still with us?
Maybe he's on the radio.
He very well could be. Well, Bill, you know,
I sat here silent just to see what Frank would do if I just vanished. You know,
he took off.
Yeah, you know, I'm ready for that, Ted.
I was like that. I used to have an uncle, and I would say when I would go, yeah, my uncle, what was it? My uncle used to love me, but she died. Anyways, I would say to him, where is my aunt? Where is this person or that person? And he'd look at me and bug his eyes out, and he'd say, well, I cut their shoelaces, and they went straight up. So, used to aggravate the fire out of me as a kid when he would say that. I was like...
Well, Ted, you know this. I'm a oral cancer survivor, so I had a third of my tongue removed by a surgeon in Birmingham and replaced with tissue from my left wrist. And he told me that the tongue is like any other muscle. The more you use it, the stronger it gets. So I basically have a prescription to talk from a physician. So I'm ready for you if you bail out on me.
There you go. There you go. Prescription for QSO. No, I
let me say one more thing. You know, everybody that rubs up against some of the things that we've done over here, they approach it as if, like you guys are, this is really a unique, interesting idea. It's really common sense. And I feel kind of embarrassed that people make such a big deal out of it. I just like operating outside, and I found out it's a lot of fun. I'm trying to share that with people. And at the bottom of everything we've talked about as far as L Expeditions and Strange Antenna Challenge and Georgia Cuso Party outings in parks and other outings in park, it comes down to the same thing. You know, I found something that I really enjoy doing, and if I can expose somebody to it or share it with them and they get the same enjoyment out of it, I've done something good, I think. And that's basically, there are no altruistic motives, right? I'm looking for a good feeling. The good feeling is, you know, somebody else in the hobby gets a goal or has fun or learns something that they didn't know to start with. And it's really as simple as that.
I'm a big believer in being selfish by doing something for others. You get more out of it than what the recipient gets.
Right.
Well, I'm going to put you on the spot here real quick, sir. Is there any good resources on the internet where someone can go and potentially either learn, research, or look more into this, into your L Expeditions, beyond just going to the Yahoo group?
You can come to the Yahoo group. In fact, if you'll send a request, I'll go ahead and approve it. It's me and UPO have, you know, approval. And the only rule is you have to participate. So if I give you access to it, you got to do something. But, you know, the messages go back there. I tend to write a report, you know, what the weather was, where I was. I've operated from historic cemeteries and all kinds of places. The other guys get on basically and just say, here's the people I talked to. But in the file section, in the photo section, there is some articles in there about building antennas specifically to be fast up, fast down. My 80-meter dipole that is 3 feet off the ground, that's my favorite, because you stomp those fence posts in the ground, takes five of them, boom, 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 and you stretch the wire and you're done. It doesn't require any shooting in trees or climbing or anything. And the whole purpose, again, is just to get on there and have fun with it. Plans, there is a trick to tuning an antenna that close to the ground. There is a trick to it, and I always show it to people in person. It's hard to describe, but there's instructions in the groups on how to tune an antenna 80 or 40, either one. When you get them down to, you know, 5 feet, 6 feet, 7 feet, 3 feet, you have to tweak with the antenna, and you have to tweak it to match it to the environment you're in. The same antenna setup that I use on top of Roan Mountain, Tennessee, will not work at Tybee Island. So, you know, and that's what's in the group. It's just basically, here's what I tried, here's what worked, here's what didn't.
And David, I'm looking at it now, and there's really quite an impressive array of files, not just by Bill, but by a number of other participants on just building local kind of battery power stuff, antennas, logs and things. So while it is just one site, it will get you going.
One of the things that we did early on, we were playing with the concept of NVIS, it's near vertical instant skywave, which it, some of the ARRL articles say it doesn't exist. It's a myth. The way I like to describe it is we're building an 80-meter two-element beam with the ground being one of the elements. That's what the tuning is all about. But in order to prove that it really was going straight up and coming straight down, and Frank, you can look at the picture there real quick. It's called Horseshoe Dam, Watauga River. I found a place that's at the bottom of a bluff in the Horseshoe Bend of the Watauga River, just downstream from Watauga Lake. The banks there go up at least 1,500 feet and probably cover 300 degrees of the sky. And the only part that's open faces back toward the lake and under about 100 feet of water at that point. So the only way out of there was straight up. That's the kind of thing we were experimenting with early on. Can I set up an antenna in a place that absolutely has no ground wave potential to the south and still get out? And the answer is yes. My first contact was in Nevada. So, yeah, we posted all that stuff there along with the instructions. And, you know, if you get into it, if you want to join the group and get into it, all I ask is you do the same thing. If you find something interesting, write about it, and pictures help too.
Well, I can tell you that NVIS antennas really work.
Okay. Oh, yes. There was an article in QST just a month ago, 2 months ago, where the guy said it's a myth, you know, and I'm wondering, okay, maybe at VHF it's a myth. Anyway, I'm not going to get into
He hasn't operated one.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was thinking.
I'll tell you.
He put it on a modeler and he modeled it, and the model said it won't work. He never actually went out and tried it.
Let me bet. Happens a lot.
I'll tell you a real quick interesting story. He's since passed on, but Phil Sissom, let me see, W4MPE was his call sign, and he operated a lot on 3895. Now, this is not exactly, I would say, a standard NVIS antenna, but his signal was absolutely horrendous. Everywhere I went, say within 300 miles of Paducah, Kentucky, where he was from, 100 miles, 200 miles, the signal of his was just horrendous. You know, I was convinced, because a lot of the other guys on 3895 were running illegal power. You know, they're running, you know, 3x5s and 3x15s and these big tubes, you know, and... But, you know, Phil was right in there with him, you know, and so I went to visit him. Matter of fact, he and his wife invited us to dinner one night, and we were on our way up to West Virginia to visit with WB8QOQ, I think it was, Bill Sams. And we went by there, and all he had on his desk was an L4B. I said, "Where's the big amp?" And he started laughing. I said, "No, Phil, seriously, I'd like to see your amplifier." He said, I don't have an amplifier. I said, "Well, you got to have one." So I literally followed the coax out of that L4B all the way through the wall and outdoors to where all, you know, and he did not have, but what he did have was underneath his 80 meter inverted V. And I still to this day don't understand the entire theory of how it operates. He had a quad loop reflector located about 3 feet off the ground underneath this inverted V. And the results of this thing were so stunning. He told the story about how everyone had reported him to the commission, and they had actually come out with a truck and monitored him, monitoring field strength, you know, thinking right. that he was running some gyratus amplifier. And all it was a quad loop reflector. And what he had was an NVIS antenna. He was shooting it straight up in the air, you know.
Yeah, two-element beam. If you set them up correctly, I swear it's amazing. You're not trying to cover the entire Earth with radio signal. You're actually concentrating your signal into a band that curves around you at 250 to 300 miles out. You know, if you're not covering the full circle, if you're pulling it down, then the signal's going to be stronger. 40 meters. I was trying to put together a 40-meter antenna here in the backyard that could do that. I had never tried 40 NVIS on 40. The MUF comes low enough in this part of the country occasionally in the evenings it'll work. But I heard these two guys talking, and so it came to a break, and I threw my call sign in. And it turned out one of the guys was in New York, and one of them was somewhere in Pennsylvania. And the New York guy had just bought a new beam, and so the Pennsylvania guy was telling him how to use it. So I threw my call sign in. The guy from New York answered. And the guy from Pennsylvania said, "He's lying to you. There's no way he's in Georgia because he's full quieting. He's booming into my radio." So, of course, if you think about it for a second, I was going straight up and coming straight down. It didn't matter which way his beam was pointing. He's going to hear me. But I could just barely hear him, right? That's how effective this really is if you set it up right. So, you know, when he turned his beam around, I could hear him at that point. And then I think he kind of believed it when he got it pointed. But, you know, even working somebody with a beam, the signal goes up, it comes straight down in a band. You've got a lot more oomph because you're not spreading out so thin. And plus, if you're working somebody with a beam, they're going to hear you no matter which way the beam's pointed.
Well, that's true. I know with international shortwave broadcast stations, there's several that have rhombics that are very close to the ground. Yeah. And that produces this straight up in the air, you know, kind of a pattern, and you can hear it. This is weird. You can be at the location of the transmitter, you know, running 100, you know, 1,000 watts or better with a portable radio on the property, and you can hear the doggone thing rolling and phasing because you've got so much energy coming directly back from the ionosphere, you know, coming straight down.
Yeah.
And it's kind of weird. It's really spooky.
I remember the Russians used to use something over there. I think it was in Hungary. They had a whole field set up to do that with, but they were using – they had 1,000,000 watts of power. Now, whether that was split amongst 10 transmitters, I don't know. But the big deal was that they could throw 1,000,000 watts into it and do exactly this, which meant that, you know, if you were in Western Europe, up around Scandinavia, on down into Africa, you're not going to hear anything but them.
Well, we are, I guess I want to say, quickly approaching the out-of-time mark. And I don't like that because, you know, I think we should be allowed to talk as long as we want to, don't you think?
Well, I mean, you signed a contract with the radio station, right?
anyhow.
he's the guy who controls the power switch, Bill.
Oh, okay. So there is no contract.
Anyhow.
He manages it.
Anyhow, I would like to go around. David, do you have any parting remarks or comments before we are forced to move along here?
I just want to say thank you for bringing this to my attention. It's a great idea. I plan on working with it.
I can see he's wound up, but go ahead.
You know, next time I take the next time I'm up, I am I'm going to go out to the park, set up, and have some fun out there. You know, it's been a little while. You know, my son's getting older, and we haven't done the park thing in a while. But I think it's due time. You know, I need to go round up a couple of his friends and just let them go out there and wear themselves out.
Bill, any final thoughts here?
I didn't believe that we could actually fill 2 hours conversing about one subject, and we didn't. We covered some neat stuff, and I really appreciate the opportunity. It's not something that I would ever thought that anybody would ever ask me to do. To keep it as quick as possible, I'll just go back and say what I said before. Frank says, you know, I do stuff. You know, it's a hobby. It's supposed to be fun. If it's not fun, you're doing it wrong. And if you're not having fun, go do something else. You know, don't be grouchy on the radio. That's where that comes from. It's not hard. Just go out in the field, set up your radio, get you a lightweight battery, and get on the air. And if you want to start a L Expedition group, call it whatever you want to around Nashville, go for it. If people catch it, it'll go.
What is your website? I know David was looking at it, and I know it's got links to some of this stuff. Why don't you give the folks your website address?
It is Yahoo. It's groups.yahoo.com, and it's a page within the Yahoo groups called L Expeditions Atlanta, all one word. And if you look up Atlanta, if you look up my call sign or Atlanta, it'll be one of the first things to pop up. My call sign is KB4KFT.
There you go. I want to thank you so much for joining. This has been fun. It's been interesting.
I know
our audience is sitting still on the edge of their chairs listening to this and thinking, wow, what a cool idea. Frank, let's turn it over to you here.
We have quite an audience, certainly on the Facebook part of the Atlanta Radio Club. I've been monitoring that. So let me give a shout out to my fellow members. Jim and Newt and Rob in particular that I know, I want to thank you for being friends and hams. And Bill and you, I want to thank you for being an inspiration as a club leader. You have helped me in the leadership roles that I have been in. And I will always keep your phrase, we do stuff, near and dear to my heart.
I appreciate that. And let me clarify one point real quick. I didn't even think about this. KI4UTY, he's the guy that built the saltwater antenna that worked. If he's listening now, I give credit where credit's due.
There you go. Thank you so much. Folks, we thank you for listening and joining us tonight for QSO Live right here on WTWW, Lebanon, Tennessee, United States of America, and 73s. You've heard us talk about the CC Skywave radio. And the only way you can do this radio justice is you have to hold one in your hand. You have to own it. You have to be able to take it out in the backyard or take it, slip it in your pocket as you travel around. It's a beautiful travel radio. Probably the best travel radio that you could possibly ever want to own. Okay, it's got AM on it, a very hot AM radio section. FM, FM stereo. It's got Weather Alert Plus. It's also got the shortwave bands, 2.3 to 26.1 megahertz continuous tuning. And it also has the Air Aviation Band. You have direct entry of frequencies and plus auto scan and store. Can you believe that? A lighted LCD display, selectable fast or fine tuning on all bands except weather. There are 400 memory presets on this radio, and it runs on two AA alkaline batteries, all right, and it runs forever. There's a stereo headphone jack and a fold-out backstand. Of course, you've seen those. The clock with 12 or 24-hour format. The alarm that's on it as well. And there's a rotary volume knob, which is kind of cool. I hate the knobs. You have to push on them, you know, and turn the volume up and down. It comes with high-quality CC buds, the earphones, and a carrying case along with a one-year warranty. Now, you can order the SkyWave radio right now. To order, all you have to do is call 1-800-522-8863. That's 1-800-522-8863, or visit them at ccrane.com. You have to mention WTWW. And the reason why we want you to do that is Bob Crane wants to know that you're supporting him as he brings you Midnight in the Desert, the Art Bell Show, as well as some of the music programming we have here on WTWW. Once again, the phone number, 1-800-522-8863. That's 522-8863. Or go to ccrane.com and be sure and mention WTWW. Ladies and gentlemen, that's all the time we have for QSO today. We'll be back same place, same time, same station with another QSO next week. So look forward to seeing you then. Special thanks goes to our co-host Frank Howell, K4FMH, as well as our special guest, Bill Perkins, KB4KFT. 73s.